Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Leviticus chapter 5, which unfortunately is going to be a very difficult chapter, verses 1 through 19. I would tell you it was about sin offerings and about guilt offerings. Well, I am going to tell you that. I wish I could tell you that the first part was about sin offerings and the last part was about guilt offerings. But unfortunately, no scholar in the world knows the difference between a sin offering and a guilt offering. At least not. At least there's not a consensus. And little old me, sure, it doesn't know the difference exactly. But I've got an idea and we'll go over it. Our context is this, Leviticus 4, verses 1 through 35. We looked at the sin offering when that's clear. We knew chapter 4 is obviously about sin offerings. So now we start with chapter 5, starting at verse 1. Now, if a person sins after he hears a public adjuration to testify when he is a witness, whether he has seen or otherwise known, if he does not tell it, then he will bear his guilt. Now, first of all, if I tell you that there is no sin, no sacrifice for an intentional sin in the Old Testament law, you'll probably believe me. I even said it in a previous podcast, and I wish I could wash my mouth out with soap, because it's not true. But everybody says that. You hear it all the time. You read it all the time. It's not true. And we'll see that as we go through here. But before we get to that interesting question, we've got to look at another dispute, and that is whether the first 13 verses of Leviticus refer to a sin offering or a guilt offering. And we need to make another note here that the modern translation for guilt offering is what the KJV and the ASV in olden days translated as trespass offering. I'm going to use the modern guilt offering. And this dispute will give you an introduction to the problems of how do you distinguish a sin offering and a guilt offering. All right, well, let's look at translations that make the first 13 verses refer to a guilt offering. Leviticus 5:6, which is the key verse. We'll look at different translations of that key verse, and we will see that many translations translate that verse as a guilt offering, and many other translations translate it as a sin offering. For example, the Young's Literal Translation brought in his guilt offering. Leviticus 5:6, New American Standard Bible, his guilt offering. He shall bring his guilt offering to the Lord. Leviticus 5:6, KJV, he shall bring his trespass offering unto the Lord. Trespass, just no word for guilt offering, old-fashioned. Leviticus 5:6, American Standard Version, he shall bring his trespass offering unto Jehovah. Leviticus 5:6, Holman Christian Study Bible, he must bring his restitution, a female lamb or goat, as a sin offering. So now we've gone from guilt offering translations to sin offering translations. The New American Bible has sin offering. So you got the same Hebrew word translated as guilt offering or sin offering, and that's one reason why it's so hard to tell what we're talking about, a sin offering or a guilt offering. Now I'm going to give you some example commentators on both sides. The commentator Kaufman says it should be translated as sin offering. Here's a quote he gave from another commentator, C.F. Kyles. The Hebrew word here does not mean trespass offering, but rather as his guilt or his trespass, and refers to the trespass or guilt of the violator, not to his offering. Now, to show you what I mean by that, or what he means by that, we can go to the ASV margin. ASV translates it as trespass offering in the text, but the margin says for his guilt, so we could read it like this, and he shall bring for his guilt a sin offering. Well, he shall bring for his guilt unto Jehovah for his sin, which he has sinned, a female from his flock, a lamb or goat, for a sin offering. Well, if you translate it that way, you avoid the embarrassing situation of having trespass offering at the first part of verse 6 and sin offering at the last half of verse 6, which doesn't make any sense to me. So I think the verse ought to be translated, he shall bring for his sin a sin offering. In other words, he shall bring for the offerer's sin a sin, an offering, which is a sin offering. It's the offerer's sin that's referring to in that word, sin offering or trespass offering, that controverted word in verse 6. However, there are other commentators that say, no, it shouldn't be an offering for his sin. It should be a guilt offering. Ellicott, Shirley, Gill, and Clark say it's guilt offering, but the problem with that is it says he shall bring his guilt offering for a sin offering. I guess you could do it this way. He shall bring his guilt offering for the person who sinned, for an offering for the person who sinned. I guess you could flip it that way. But either way, it's extremely confusing and controversial. And as I say, there are commentators on both sides of the issue. There's a scholarly article that I found in JSTOR, the Academic Archive, N.H. Snaith, S-N-A-I-T-H, says that it is, quote-unquote, customary to classify a guilt offering as a type of sin offering. So you don't have two different types of offerings. You just have a guilt offering is a special type of a sin offering. And that's because they're close together. Now, a website that I encountered discussing this issue says that the difference between sin and guilt offerings has been debated for centuries. A brother named Shirley. Here's some suggested differences. The sin offering refers to the sin itself, but trespass offerings are given for the effect of sin. Here's another option. The sin offering is given for its sin itself, but the trespass offering, the guilt offering, is given for the guilt of sin. To me, that's a distinction without a difference. Some people say that the sin offering is for sin against God, whereas others say that and they also say that the guilt offering is for sin against man. Some say that the distinction is this: the sin offering is for the wrong done, and the guilt offering is for the right that's undone. In other words, the sin offering is for the commission of sins, the guilt offering is for the omission of sins. And some people say there's no difference at all. This is Smith says that. He doesn't say that. He says that there are people out there who say there's no difference at all between the sin and the guilt offering. The NIV Study Bible, apparently, if I read them correctly, say that a sin offering refers to unintentional sin against non-holy things, whereas a guilt offering is offered for unintentional sin against holy things, things that are involved with the temple sacrifice. I'm not real happy with that. I'm going to tell you what I'm happy with right here. This is from the article Snaith, Dr. Snaith, I'm not sure which, his article on JSTOR. He says the distinction is this: a guilt offering is offered when there is no damage done from the offense, assuming the offense was unintentional. But a guilt offering is done when the offense causes damage. So since this is going to be my solution to the problem, and again, if I'm wrong, well, that's okay. There's a million other different opinions out there, as I've just mentioned, and I can find somebody to back me up and still be credible. So we're going to go with this. There's four possibilities. The offense is unintentional and causes no damage. Well, then the offering that is applicable is a sin offering. The offense is unintentional and no damage is done, then it's a sin offering. That's option number one. Option number two, the offense is intentional and it causes damage. Well, in that case, the guilt offering applies, not the sin offering, but the guilt offering applies. That's option number two. Option number three, the offense is unintentional and causes damage. Well, the guilt offering applies there. So whether the offense is intentional or unintentional is absolutely irrelevant if there's damage. Let me give you a quote from Snaith backing me up on that. He says, "The fact that the offense has been committed unknowingly is beside the point. It is the loss that has been sustained which fixes the case as requiring a guilt offering." So that's what you look at. Is there a loss? Is there damage? Intent or unintent makes no difference. But if it's unintentional, you go back to a sin offering, because that's what sin offerings are for, unintentional sin. That makes a lot of sense. Now, there's a fourth possibility, which is a little bit hairier. The offense is intentional and causes no damage. Well, if it's intentional, it can't require a sin offering, because we read in Leviticus 4:2, "Tell the Israelites, when someone sins unintentionally against any of the Lord's commands and does anything prohibited by them, da 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 da, then you do a sin offering." So Leviticus 4:2 tells you that it's unintentional sins for sin offerings. And that's not controverted. Everybody agrees with that. But in our fourth scenario here, if the offense is intentional, that knocks out a sin offering by Leviticus 4:2, but then it causes no damage. Well, you can't do restitution if there's no damage. So I would assume that a guilt offering would be offered there, because you can just say, well, a guilt offering is necessary, but you don't need to make restitution because there wasn't any damage. You can't take 20% of zero, zero. All right, well, we'll keep Snaith's solution there in mind as we go through the text. Snaith gives three reasons for the horrible confusion over this issue. His first reason is that there is confusion between the guilt offering and the sin offering in the sacrificial Levitical code itself. For example, I'll give you an example. In the first 13 verses of Leviticus 5, it goes from intentional to unintentional sins. It goes from sin, well, we can't talk about the translations. I'm talking about the code itself. It goes between intentional and unintentional sins. So there you have a problem. Causes confusion, causes me confusion. The second reason for the confusion is the Hebrew. Now, I don't know Hebrew, but Sne says that it's difficulty understanding exactly what the Hebrew word means. And the third reason for the confusion, according to Sneath, is the confusion in the English translations. There's more diversity in the English translations, even more than the original Hebrew. You put all that together, and you've got a big piece of meat to chew. We're going to try. We're going to start in verse 1, which I read a while back. If a person sins after he hears a public adjuration to testify when he is a witness. In other words, he's subpoenaed to go into court. To put it to modern terms, he said, no, I'm not going to testify. Well, just like in modern law, you do that, you go to jail. They'll send out a bench warrant. They'll put you in the cooler. You have to testify. No court system can work if witnesses refuse to testify. So this first sin here needs a sacrifice. What is it? Is it a sin offering or is it a trespass offering? Well, the NIV Study Bible says it's a sin offering because it's unintentional. Well, let me ask you something. How in the world can somebody hear a public adjuration to testify, refuse with a high hand to go to court, and you tell me that's unintentional? That's ludicrous. It is not unintentional. It is obviously intentional. And so under my Snaith scenario, my Snaith framework, I would say that a trespass offering is necessary for verse 1. The refusal to testify in court. Now, I'm not alone in thinking this is intentional, not unintentional. The commentator Shirley that I just quoted, he says it's intentional. I think he's right. I found another it's a Jewish Christian website, lightofmessiah.org. That's intentional. And of course it's intentional. I don't see how it's even questioned. But the NIV Study Bible insists that it's unintentional. I'd love to sit down and talk with the brother who wrote that note and say, now you explain to me how that's unintentional. How can you unintentionally refuse to offer a summons to court? Ellicott, on the other hand, says it is intentional. He says, quote, the guilt here described is that of designed and culpable silence and of deliberately concealing a crime. Well, that sure sounds intentional to me. That doesn't sound unintentional. Now, I mentioned that so many people say that there is no offering or sacrifice in the Levitical law for intentional sins. Well, if Leviticus 5:1 is intentional, guess what? There's sacrifice for intentional sins. But nonetheless, gotquestions.org, a very respectable website, says there is no offering that covers intentional sins. And there's millions of people that say that. It is not true. Unless I'm missing something, and I don't think I am. We go to Leviticus 5:2. Or if a person touches any unclean thing, whether a carcass of an unclean beast or the carcass of unclean cattle or a carcass of unclean swarming things, though it is hidden from him and he is unclean, then he will be guilty. Now, verse 2 is obviously accidental, unwitting. He accidentally stumbles over a deer by the side of the road that's dead, like I almost did the other day riding my bicycle. But flies buzzing all over the place, the stench for about 20 yards on every side of that deer. A car apparently hit it. Well, if I had hit the deer, that would be accidental, not willing, not intentional. And then he will be guilty, or basically that means unclean. An unclean beast that's mentioned here would be something like a camel, a rabbit, or a pig, as described in Leviticus 11. Unclean cattle would be unclean livestock, for example, a horse or an ass. Leviticus 11 says, concerning all the animals which divide the hoof but do not make a split hoof, that would be a horse, or which do not chew cud, that would be a horse, or an ass, or a donkey. Now, this touching of an unclean animal or swarm, that'd be like a swarm of flies or something, although it is hidden from him, NIV says he's unaware, how can that be? Well, there's two ways. You could accidentally touch the animal, or it could be you touched the animal, but you weren't aware of the law because you weren't a priest. You didn't realize that this particular animal was ritually unclean. At any rate, no intent, so sin offering covers that clearly. And so now we've got trespass offering and a sin offering mixed together in the same section, and that's why there's so much confusion. In fact, that's probably why some people say that, hey, a guilt offering is just a subset of a sin offering. Now, there's three ways you can be unclean with an animal. You can touch the dead body of a clean animal. You could touch the live body of an unclean animal. Or you could touch the dead body of an unclean animal. Now, the verse says you're guilty if you do this. The Septuagint translation of the Hebrew text omits the word guilty, as Ellicott points out. And that makes sense. Why should we say someone is guilty for touching a camel or for touching a donkey? That's ridiculous. It just means you're ritually unclean. Guilty sounds like you're morally culpable. No, it means you're Levitically unclean. You can't do temple activities while you're unclean. You can't do a peace offering or something like that in the temple. We go to Leviticus 5:3. Not the temple, I'm sorry, the tabernacle. Leviticus 5:3. Or if he touches human uncleanness, a person touches human uncleanness, of whatever sort his uncleanness may be with which he becomes unclean, and it is hidden from him, and then he comes to know it, he will be guilty. And again, it's not guilty, he will be unclean. Human uncleanness is described in Leviticus 11 through 15, which we will go through when we get there. Here's some examples: the dead body of a man, the bones of a dead body, a grave, menstrual blood. Those are four examples of human uncleanness. And how does a person come to know about it? Having unintentionally touched human uncleanness. Well, he might not realize he sat on a bed where a woman had been menstruating, for example. He might have walked across a grave and not realized it. However, he's Levitically unclean, needs to offer a sin offering. It's unintentional. There's no damage done. This is obviously a sin offering, not a guilt offering. So we go to Leviticus 5:4. Or if a person swears thoughtlessly with his lips to do evil or to do good, in whatever matter a man may speak thoughtlessly with an oath, and it is hidden from him, and then he comes to know it, he will be guilty in one of these. Well, how can a person swear thoughtlessly? This is the rash oath. Well, you could swear for something that's impossible to do. I'll pay you $1 million if you'll quit your job and come work with me. Well, you can't. That's a rash oath. There's no way you're going to pay somebody $1 million. Well, it's possible, I guess. So whether it's impossible to do or close to impossible to do, very difficult to do, it's a rash oath. You don't really mean it. Could be an oath that's unlawful to do. For example, you come near my wife again and I'm going to kill you. Well, that's a rash oath. That's thoughtless. You don't threaten somebody to do something. You don't threaten to break the law to do something to somebody. So there's two examples of a rash oath. Swears thoughtlessly with his lips to do evil or to do good. That means, I just gave you an example of good and evil. It just means anything you can do. It's an idiom, actually, to do evil or to do good. That means anything you do. So you make any kind of a rash oath. You can make it carelessly, like, oh, I'll pay you $1 million if you quit your job. And you don't really mean it. You're just talking. That's a careless oath. Or you could do, it could be a passionate oath. I'll give you $1 million if you'll quit your job and come work for me. Ellicott says either carelessly or passionately. In other words, it's not deliberated with a cool, balanced mind. Now, how can such an oath be hidden from him? Well, because he didn't think much about it when he said it, or his passion passes and he just forgets about it because he doesn't really mean to do it. For example, I'll swim the English Channel to show you my love for you. You don't really mean to do that, and then you forget about it. You find another girl. And all of a sudden, the first girl comes back and says, you said you would love me forever, and you'd swim the English Channel for me. Oops, I forgot about that rash oath. So that's how it's hidden. You just forget about it. Both John Gill and Ellicott make the point that the way you have an oath hidden to yourself is you just forget about it. Now, this is an unwilling violation with no damage, and of course, that requires a sin offering, not a guilt offering. How does the person with a hidden that's swore a rash oath that is hidden from him, how does he come to know about it? When somebody tells him, hey, remember that oath you made? The NASB says that the oath taker will be guilty in one of these. That's, to me, is a hideously literal translation. The Holman Christian Study Bible has in one of such things. So you will be guilty in one of such things. You'll be guilty of taking a rash oath. And again, there's a little bit more moral culpability there than ritual uncleanliness, but of course it's probably both, I would think, in that case. We go to Leviticus 5, verses 5 through 6. So it shall be when he becomes guilty in one of these, and one such thing, like a rash oath, that he shall confess that in which he has sinned. He shall also bring his guilt offering to the Lord for his sin which he has committed. a female from the flock, a lamb or a goat as a sin offering. Well, here you go. Leviticus 5:6, that's the verse I said where you got guilt offering and sin offering in the same verse, which sounds a little contradictory. So the priest shall make an atonement on his behalf for his sin. Well, let me just say right now, the best way to do is to take a different translation. He shall also bring as his offering for his guilt to the Lord a sin offering. Now, that works fine if you translate it that way, and that'll do. Verse 5 says, when he becomes guilty in a rash oath, he shall confess that which he has sinned. When, I would say probably at the time that he's making the sacrifice, he'll just confess it to the priest. It's a Jewish priest, not a Catholic priest, but he can still make the confession to him. John Gill says it could be before the sacrifice, but who knows? Who cares? That's up to the rabbis. The NIV, John Gill and Adam Clark say, the NIV Study Bible, say that the offering was no good without the confession. You got to confess. You don't confess, forget the offering. It's not going to do any good. Now, is this rash oath, is it intentional or unintentional? It's probably unintentional, because at the time of the rash oath, the oath taker was not intending to keep the oath. He intended to make a rash oath, no question. But he wasn't intending to keep an oath, and that's what's more important, and completely forgot about it. So he was unaware. So we would say this is unintentional, and unintentional sins take a sin offering, and that's what it says in verse 6. A lamb or a goat is a sin offering. And in fact, a lamb or a goat was a sin offering for a common Israelite. A female lamb or goat, and that's what it says here. So that proves that it's a sin offering here, not a guilt offering that's being required. Guilt offerings were always required a ram, which is a male sheep. But this is a female lamb or goat, and that's a female sheep or a goat. And the translations differ on whether it's sheep or lamb, too. That's another confusing thing, the age of the animal. But it doesn't matter. This is obviously a sin offering that's being required. So the priest shall make atonement on his behalf for his sin. Atonement means to appease an angry God, to reconcile the angry God with the offeror, and to cover his sins. All three ideas are present in that word atonement, harmartion. The Greek is harmartion, not the Hebrew, of course. Now, to show you how to translate verse 6, I just did it off the cuff here, but let me give you the NIV translation to show how the NIV translation gets rid of that guilt offering. He shall also bring his guilt offering. It's not in the NIV. It says, and it's a penalty for the sin he has committed. Instead of saying a guilt offering, it's a penalty for the sin he, the offeror, has committed. Not the type, the sin doesn't go with the offering, the sin goes with the offeror. As a penalty for the sin he has committed, he must bring a ... sin offering. Now, John Gill takes a different take on this. He says that the fact that trespass offering and sin offering in the same verse are referred to in the same verse says that that shows that there's no difference between a sin offering and a trespass offering, which is logical. I don't believe it, but it is logical. Quote from John Gill, it is generally thought there was a difference between a trespass offering and a sin offering, but it is not easy to say wherein the difference lies. Hear, hear to that. And what has been observed by learned men is not very satisfactory. Hear, hear, Mr. Gill. And certain it is that the same offering is here called both a trespass offering and a sin offering. So that would be one of the options I gave you earlier, that there's no difference between the two. John Gill holds to that. Well, the sin offering is required a female lamb or goat for the ordinary Israelite who's not poor. Poor Israelites aren't mentioned. Well, actually, that's coming up. The poor Israelite, his substitute offering of a dove or a turtle dove will be mentioned. The high priest of the congregation's sin, if the high priest made a rash oath, he would have to bring a bull, but that's unusual, and that's why it's not mentioned. Again, no law code can mention every possible circumstance. You have to reason from what you've got to a particular situation. If I had that case, if I was a Jewish rabbi, I would say, okay, the high priest made a rash oath. He needs to confess his rash oath, and he needs to offer a bull for his sin offering, because that's what high priest sin offerings require in chapter 4 of Leviticus. Now we go to Leviticus 5, 7 through 10. But if he cannot afford a lamb, that's the person who made the rash oath and sinned, then he shall bring to the Lord his guilt offering for that in which he has sinned. Well, we just told you it was a sin offering. Wonderful translation, NASB, nothing to confuse us with. Two turtle doves or two young pigeons, one for a sin offering and the other for a burnt offering. So here you got in verse 7 the same thing, guilt offering, sin offering, two different words for the same offering. Well, let's just fix it right now. Holman Christian Study Bible says, he shall bring as a penalty for the guilt of his sin a sin offering. putting the sin on the offeror instead of on the offering. He shall bring to the Lord as a penalty for his sin, or as a penalty for his guilt, he shall bring a sin offering. That fixes it. However, there's translations which still maintain that two different words to the same sacrifice, guilt offering and sin offering. For example, the NASB, the one I just read you, the Young's Literal Translation, the American Standard Version, God's Word Translation, The only way, if you're going to maintain that translation, you have to say that a guilt offering is the same thing as a sin offering, and John Gill would be right. Now notice that this person who's made a rash offering, he not only offers a sin offering, he offers a burnt offering. And I think that's general. I think you can extrapolate to all sin offerings that you offer a burnt offering with it. You might not say that, but I think that's a reasonable interpretation. Although John Gill says the poor had an extra burnt offering thrown in with the sin offering, unlike the rich people who only had to do the sin offering. I don't know about that. Why would you make the poor throw in an extra burnt offering, but not the rich? Well, the poor man's burnt offering, as we read in chapter 1, is either a dove or a pigeon, poor man's choice, and that's ditto for the sin offering, which was in chapter 4. Poor man could either offer a dove or a pigeon for a burnt offering, for a sin offering. So for a burnt offering and a sin offering, it's the same two animals if you're poor, dove or a pigeon. And that's why there are two doves or two pigeons, two turtle doves or two pigeons, because one's for the sin offering and one's for the burnt offering. Nothing contradictory or difficult about that, according to the laws laid down in Leviticus 1 and Leviticus 4. Leviticus 1 for burnt offerings and Leviticus 4 for sin offerings. Verse 8, he, the offeror, the poor man, shall bring them, the turtle doves or the pigeons, depending on which choice he made. Apparently, turtle doves and pigeons don't hang around with each other. So if you got one, you're probably going to, and they show up at different times of the year, so you would either get two of one or two of the other, depending on when you're bringing the offering. The poor man shall bring them to the priest, who shall offer first that which is for the sin offering. Why would that be? Well, it makes sense to take care of your sin first, and then you've got the freedom to praise God with the burnt offering. Burnt offering, of course, shows total devotion to God and praise to God. Sin is covering your sin. That's sort of like what we do. We say, thank you, Jesus, for forgiving my sin first, and then after that we can praise God because he's forgiven us for our sin. Verse 8, he shall bring them, the poor man shall bring the turtle dove or the dove or the pigeon, I should say, to the priest, who shall offer first that which is for the sin offering. I've already read that. And shall nip its head at the front of its neck. The NIV has wring his head at the front of his neck, or wring his head. The Holman Christian Study Bible says he must twist its head at the back of the neck without severing it. Isn't that great? Without severing it, the back of the neck, whereas the NASB says at the front of the neck. What can you say? Somewhere the pigeon or dove's head is wrung, but he, the offerer, shall not sever the head. And it doesn't say why, but I suspect that if you sever a head from a bird, you got two little pieces of a bird, which would be real easy to get lost in the shuffle of all these sacrifices going on, and hard to keep them together, easy to get separated. So that's probably why the law required them to keep the animal together. Now, these sin offerings accompanying the burnt offerings is according to the ordinance, verse 10, it's the burnt offering. The second bird he shall then prepare as a burnt offering according to the ordinance. That's the ordinance of the burnt offerings in chapter 1. So the priest shall make atonement on his behalf for his sin which he has committed, and will be forgiven him. Again, atonement is appeasement of an angry God in order to reconcile the angry God with the believer by covering his sins. Appeasement, reconciliation, and covering. That's what the word atonement means. Let me go back to verse 8 a minute. The priest shall offer first that which is the sin offering. It doesn't say that what happens after the bird was burnt up on the altar and the blood is poured out at the base. Adam Clark says the bird was the priest's property because they got what was left over of a burnt offering most of the time, except in the case of the high priest or the whole congregation's sin. But in ordinary people's sins, the priest kept the cooked remainder of the bird, which was eaten in the courtyard. Leviticus 6:26 says that the priest who offers it for sin shall eat it. It shall be eaten in a holy place in the court of the tent of meeting. That's for sin offerings in general in Leviticus 6. And since a bird is a sin offering, it's logical to conclude that's where it's eaten too. We go down to Leviticus 5:11. But if his means are insufficient for two turtle doves or two young pigeons, now we're talking about very poor people, can't even buy two turtle doves or two pigeons, then for his offerings, for his offering for that which he has sinned, he shall bring the tenth of an ephah of fine flour for his sin offering. He shall not put oil on it or place incense on it, for it is a sin offering. Now, a tenth of an ephah is about 2 quarts, or about 35 liters. It was for the extremely poor, for those who couldn't even afford two turtle doves and a pigeon. The doves or pigeon options were for poor Israelites. This is for extremely poor Israelites. In his love, God provides for the atonement of the very poor as much as for the rich. Now, this was a sin offering without blood, the only one. But note that the flour was placed on the other animals which are being sacrificed, and so it sort of participates in a blood sacrifice. Verse 12, we'll see that. So the blood of those other sacrifices will then cover the 2/10 of an ephah of flour. Now, there was no oil on this flour sin offering. So we need to distinguish the regular grain offering, which we talked about in chapter 2. We need to distinguish the regular grain offering and the grain offering that accompanied the sin offering for the poor person. There's a distinction. No oil on the sin offering of the poor person. Why? Well, it's a sin offering, and you generally don't associate sin with something that not only has value because of its medicinal qualities, but also because it tastes good. So you would want to make a sin offering less attractive than a grain offering. I think that makes sense. Also, by not requiring oil, it made the offering less expensive for the poor person, as John Gill points out, because oil had some value. Also, no incense either was put on this bread. Incense was put on the grain offering, chapter 2, but not here, because it says don't put oil on it or place incense on it. We go now to Leviticus 5, verses 12 through 13. He shall bring it to the priest, and the priest shall take his handful of it as its memorial portion and offer it up in smoke on the altar with the offerings of the Lord by fire. It is a sin offering, so the priest shall make atonement for him concerning his sin which he has committed from one of these, and it will be forgiven him. Then the rest shall become the priest like the grain offering. All right, what is this memorial portion? The priest would always take a pinch of the flour of any grain offering offered and would put it on the altar. That part belonged to God. Why is it called a memorial? A memorial is something that is brought to mind. Well, what's brought to mind? I assume it's God's mind. Well, the offer of sin might be made to offer to God. That's John Gill's option. Or it could be a memorial to the people of the goodness of God in providing an offering for sin. Now, verse 12 says that the memorial portion is burnt up on the altar with the offerings. That's the other sin and burnt offerings that might be burning at the time. The NIV, instead of having with the offerings, the NIV says on top of the offerings, which makes sense. You would sprinkle it right there on top of all the other sacrifices that are burning. And that the 2/10 of an ephah grain is called a sin offering. Verse 12. Verse 13, the priest shall make atonement. As I've said many times, atonement is appeasement of a wrathful God in order to make reconciliation with the believer by covering his sins. Appeasement, reconciliation, and covering. And the sins will be forgiven the offeror. Last part of verse 13, then the rest, that means the rest of the flour, shall become the priest. And so the bread will be cooked. Either, I assume it will be cooked just like the burnt, just like the grain offering. Remainders after the memorial portion are cooked, either as cakes, as bread on a griddle, or thin wafers. Doesn't say that. That's just my speculation. But it does say the rest of the grain shall become the priest like the grain offering. So if it belongs to the priest, like the grain offering belongs to the priest, well, the grain offering belonged to the priest in the form of cooked bread. Priest got to eat. And, of course, I assume he ate it in the courtyard somewhere. Now, the priest didn't have to take the remainder of the grain offering in cooked form. He could take it raw if he wanted to. I guess if he wasn't hungry, he'd cook it later. Leviticus 5, 14 through 15, then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, if a person acts unfaithfully and sins unintentionally against the Lord's holy things, then he shall bring his guilt offering to the Lord. A ram without defect from the flock, according to your valuation in silver by shekels, in terms of the shekel of the sanctuary for a guilt offering. Verse 14 says, the Lord spoke to Moses, that would be from the tabernacle, way back in chapter 1, verse 1, Then the Lord called to Moses and spoke to him from the tent of meeting, which is the tabernacle now, and we're still in the middle of that conversation, God speaking to Moses. Verse 15, If a person acts unintentionally against the Lord's holy things. Well, what are holy things? Well, here's some examples. Gill and Clark and Jameson, Fawcett and Brown all together come up with this list. Payment of tithes not done. Offerings of the first fruits not done properly. Maybe somebody ate one of the first fruits. Eating sacred things he ought not to eat. Maybe he ate the showbread. Got confused. Oh, look at here, this nice bread here. He eats a loaf and then somebody comes. I was getting ready to put that on the bread of the presence table in the holy place, but you ate it. The failure to redeem the firstborn of his cattle or his children. Withholding what a man had vowed to pay. Eating food that belonged to priests. All right, so there's your list of holy things. Anything that had to do with the tabernacle and the Levitical law, you violated it, you have to give a guilt offering to the Lord. Now, let me give you a summary of the guilt offering according to my table from the NIV Study Bible. First of all, a guilt offering always involved the sacrifice of a ram, which is a male sheep. You don't have to remember anything else. Ram, that's it. The purpose was for mandatory atonement for unintentional sin. Well, that's disputed, unintentional sin and intentional sin. But it's basically to take away sin, whereas the sin offering was just for unintentional sin. And this guilt offering required restitution when possible. It was also meant to cleanse from defilement, and the restitution was 20%. God's portion, as always, was the fat, the enteral fat, the kidney fat, the liver fat, the lobe of the liver, the covering of the liver, the fatty covering. And if it was a sheep, the fat tail. That's standard in all the sacrifices. You don't have to worry about that. God gets the fat because fat stands for the best part of the animal. The priest portion was all the remainder besides the fat, and the priest had to eat it within the court of the tabernacle. Now the offerer got nothing. In the fellowship offering, he got to eat with the priest, eat some flesh, eat some meat, but not with a guilt offering. He ate nothing. Now the NIV Study Bible has an interesting note here. They say that when a guilt offering is not possible, or when a restitution of a guilt offering is not possible, the sin offering was offered instead. And of course, my question would be, if I had those scholars in front of me, I'd say, well, what situation would make damages impossible? You can always give damages if it's the death, if the aggrieved party has his child killed, for example. We can put a monetary damage on that, monetary damage amount. So I don't know why restitution would ever be impossible. So I don't know why the NIV Study Bible comes up with that idea. Now, verse 15 says that the guilt offering is brought to the Lord. Why? Well, because in this particular example, the offense was against the Lord, against the Lord's holy thing. So you bring the guilt offering to the Lord. Now, the NIV says this is what trespass offering is. It's merely unintentional sin against the Lord's holy things. But I don't think so. I mean, if somebody did something intentionally to his neighbor, he would have to offer the restitution to his injured neighbor. Plus 20%. But this is against the Lord because it's defiling unintentionally God's holy things. And again, according to Snaith, it doesn't matter whether it's unintentional or intentional. With a guilt offering, restitution should be made and a guilt offering should be offered. So a ram without defect from the flock, as I said, all trespass offerings were rams according to your valuation. A ram is a male sheep according to your valuation, and that's a problem here. What's being valued in silver by shekels? The ram or the damage done to the aggrieved party? Well, in this case, in our case here, the aggrieved party is the Lord. Let's say that a party forgot, didn't mean to, but forgot to offer his first fruit sheep to the Lord. Well, you just take the value of the sheep, add 20% of it, and that's it. Now, that word valuation, according to your valuation in silver by shekels, that could be according to the valuation of the damage done to the aggrieved party, in this case, the Lord. So let's say you owe the Lord a first fruit of your donkey. Your donkey has a child. Oh, it's time to offer to the Lord, and you don't do it. Well, you figure out what the donkey's worth, add 20% to it. That's what you pay. Or it could mean the ram is valued. You have to bring a ram of proper value. And what does that mean? Well, we can go down to verse 18. We say, the offeror, is then to bring to the priest a ram without defect from the flock according to your valuation as a guilt offering. In other words, you have to value the ram, and according to Gil, the ram had to be worth at least 2 shekels. So you value the ram properly is the word down there in verse 18. Actually, it doesn't say proper value. John Gill says that that's what it means, though. So you either bring a ram of proper value to atone for the unintentional sin, or you value the damage done because of the unintentional sin. And in either case, whichever case it is, you add 20% to it. Of course, it could be both. It could be verse 16 talking about the damage done, the monetary loss. And verse 18 could be the proper valuation of the ram. It could be both. I tend to think verse 16 makes it sound like it's the value of the damage done, restitution for that which he has sinned against. Take a fifth, 20%. There's your 20%. Give it to the priest. So that makes it sound like it's the valuation there is talking about the valuation of the damage. But then in verse 18, it sounds like the valuation of the ram. He is to bring to the priest a ram according to your valuation. Well, in my opinion, it ought to be the value of the damage, 20% plus the damage. Just makes more sense that way to me. So verse 18 says the atonement will be gotten. And verse 19 says it's a guilt offering. He's guilty before the Lord. And to me, this is more than just uncleanness here. It was unintentional, I guess. He forgot to make an offering. I guess he's not really morally guilty. But he is Levitically guilty and unclean. So he's got to be cleansed with a trespass offering. Now, why was this fifth added to the restitution value, 20%? Well, it was necessary to add a penalty. If the penalty were not present, the offender would merely have to replace what he was supposed to give anyway. He's not punished any. He had to give it anyway. He damaged somebody. Let's say he accidentally wandered off with somebody's sheep, let it out of the pen, and he got into his pen. He didn't mean to do it. Well, he has to give it away, but he's not going to be penalized any for doing it. So you put a 20% penalty on it. That's going to make him a lot careful not to walk away with somebody else's sheep. I have just finished listening to this audio, and I have decided that it needs to be redone completely from the beginning because of the complications of distinguishing a sin and guilt offering. But instead of redoing it, because I don't have the time, what I'm going to do is give you the conclusions of an article by an N.H. Snaith. This article is called The Sin Offering and the Guilt Offering in a publication called Vetus Testamentum. It's quoted a lot in dealing with this issue. First of all, which scripture refers to each offering? According to N.H. Snaith, the sin offering is referred to in Leviticus 4, verse 1 through Leviticus 5, verse 13. The guilt offering is referred to in Leviticus 5, verse 14 through Leviticus 6, verse 7. Now, as far as which type of sin is covered by each respective offering, a sin offering covers unknown sins and a guilt offering covers known sins and unknown sins. There's a problem with that dichotomy, though. If we say that a sin offering covers unknown sins, we have a problem with Leviticus 5:1. When someone sins in any of these ways, if he has seen, heard, or known about something he has witnessed and did not respond to a public call to testify, he is responsible for his sin. Now that sounds like a known sin. You refuse to be a witness in a court case. Now, Mr. Snaith finesses this. He says this witness has seen something and had forgotten about it, and so it's an unknown sin. That sounds like a stretch to me. I think I would just prefer to say it's an exception to the general rule. Now, as far as reparations, a sin offering, when it was given, there were no reparations made to an offended party, but with a guilt offering, reparations were indeed made. Now, there are a couple of exceptions, at least, to this rule that reparations are made when a trespass offering, a guilt offering, is involved. For example, there are no reparations given by a leper when he is cleansed, and yet he was to offer a restitution offering, a guilt offering, a trespass offering. We read in Leviticus 14:12, the priest is to take one male lamb and present it as a restitution offering. That's the Hillman Christian Study Bible's translation for guilt offering, along with 1/3 quart of olive oil, and he must wave them as a presentation offering before the Lord. Likewise, just as there were no reparations in the ritual ceremony for the cleansing of a leper and the attendant restitution offering, there were no reparations owed by a Nazirite who violated his vow and yet was required to give a guilt offering, a restitution offering. Numbers 6:12. He, that's the Nazirite, is to rededicate his time of consecration to the Lord and to bring a year-old male lamb as a restitution offering. Holman Christian Study Bible, that's a guilt offering. Well, we could just say those are exceptions to the rule. Mr. Snaith does not mention those two exceptions, but another Catholic scholar named P.P. Sadon, or Sadon, S-A-Y-D-O-N, says that these two exceptions vitiate the rule. They eat up the rule. So we can't make a general rule and say that guilt offerings involve reparations. Well, we can say that most of the time they do anyway. Now let's look at some translation issues. According to Mr. Snaith, he says we should not use guilt offering, and I completely agree with that. It leads to confusion. Now, the classic example of this is in Leviticus 5:6, which is in the sin offering section. We read this, "He shall also bring his guilt offering." But wait a minute, we're talking about sin offerings, are we not? That's what verses 1 through 13 are about. And not only the context shows in verse 6 that the subject addressed is a sin offering, verse 6 itself says it's a sin offering. So let me read that again in the NASB. "He shall also bring his guilt offering to the Lord, a female from the flock, a lamb or a goat, as a sin offering." So right in the same verse, we have guilt offering and sin offering referring to the same sacrifice, which is utterly confusing. Well, the Holman Christian Study Bible translates it this way. "He must bring his restitution for the sin he has committed to the Lord, a female lamb or goat from the flock, as a sin offering." So if you would just get rid of the term guilt offering completely, that allows you to use restitution when restitution needs to be made, or when there's guilt involved in a sin offering, and just get rid of the term guilt offering and use another translation, such as compensation offering. Snaith suggests the Holman Christian Study Bible translates guilt offering all the way through as restitution offering, and I believe that's exactly what should be done. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished Leviticus 5, this vexatious and difficult chapter. I hope you've gotten something out of it. We are now prepared in our next audio to go to Leviticus chapter 6, 1 through 30, the entire chapter, which will be laws for the priest, how they are to do their duty. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.